What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I'm, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with the frontman for the band Wheatus, Brendan B. Brown. Now, of course, they're known for their 2000 single, Teenage Dirtbag. The song has taken on a new life on TikTok. It's gone viral. Some listeners will undoubtedly be familiar. The song was just re-released back in 2020, and Brendan actually graces us with a special acoustic performance of Teenage Dirtbag on a nylon guitar, which he told me was 100 years old and that he's never played the song on that guitar before. So it was his first time doing it. And now I give you Brendan B. Brown. Okay. I am here with the frontman for Wheatus, otherwise known as Brendan B. Brown. Brendan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. How are you?
I am doing very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
I'd like to wind the clock back a little bit, Brendan, to the beginning. I'd love to know, when was it that you discovered that you had a passion for music, and how did you foster it?
I was two years old. My parents tell a story of me singing along to Bobby Darin's Mack the Knife in the mirror.
No,
yeah, and just kind of like watching myself tap my foot, kind of getting it right. So, you know, the objective reality of music was very much happening as soon as I could think. And when I was 8 years old, my mother, who was a guitar player, is a guitar player, taught me how to play My Girl on her sort of nylon classical guitar that like a nun would have, you know. So I learned its Temptations track, My Girl, and suddenly it was like kind of like I had a superpower or something like that. Like it opened up a secret capability that, you know, I could always just grab the guitar and make something. It was me and the guitar and then a third thing called a song, you know. And the third, being able to make a third thing at will was put the nail in the coffin as far as me being obsessed with this instrument. So I taught myself how to play guitar for the next 27 million years. I still don't know how to read music. I'm still actively trying to teach myself how to play things I don't understand.
Cool.
Most recent example of that would be in 2016. I wrote and recorded with the band a Wheatus song called Lullaby, which was my attempt at making a sort of Somewhere Over the Rainbow style jazz standard narrative arc with arrangement and everything. But producing it and recording it with the most blown out modern like noise metal sounds I could come up with. So that was the experiment with that, and that was a long way to go. Incidentally, it's a good thing that we're not on a label anymore, because that would have been the kind of thing a label would never have. Like, they would have been like, what are you doing? Like, you're totally wasting your time. But there are a handful of people who came back to me and were like, okay, now I like Wheatus. You know, now you've made something that I can dig. And I still carry on conversations with those people on Twitter about noise rock and, you know, psychedelic jazz and stuff that they would never have talked to me about. It's just because of Teenage Dirtbag or whatever.
Right, right.
Not that we dislike that song. We quite love Teenage Dirtbag, but it's like this process of teaching yourself how to play something new that you can't do. Teaching yourself how to do something you can't do yet has been my guitar world since I was 8. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. Just out of curiosity, it made me kind of think of it. What's the reason why a studio wouldn't want to back a song like that?
Well, a studio might, but a label,
excuse me,
probably wouldn't want to pay for that type of book. If I came to our A&R guy back in 2001, even after Teenage Dirtbag had kind of done its thing and gone and become a radio hit, if I'd have said, hey, check out this song, Lullaby, you know, it's jazz, it's really gnarly psychedelic metal sounds that I'm looking to produce this with. It's about heroin addiction amongst the baby boomers. And, you know, like they would have been like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, right.
Hard pass. We're not paying for that, you know? So that's kind of a full circle for us to be just be able to still be a band and do things like that if we feel like it. And also record some pop accessible rock songs that we feel good about. That's all still happening. So it's, you know, it's the whole thing. I've never been a fan of the whole like, where a band goes and does a whole bunch of records. And over the course of that record, those records, they become a band that they, where they can't get back to where they started. Like they're not that band anymore kind of thing.
That's kind of weird.
I always think that's weird. Like if you, like, you know, Rush plays, or when they were touring before Neil died, Rush would play Working Man just as well as they played the Manhattan Project, you know? So yeah. It's kind of like that, like building a library, you're not morphing into something else that you won't be anymore. You know, I call them, you know.
Sure.
There are times in history where genre-defiant pieces have gotten themselves through the goalpost and met with the public reception that they kind of are made for. And it doesn't matter to consumers, to people who consume art, it doesn't matter to them that it doesn't really have a genre. That's just a retail capitalistic thing. It's a retail capitalistic protection racket, you know?
Right.
It's like these huge companies have a bottom line and they're terrified that the executives themselves are terrified that they're going to make the move that ends their career. And what you get instead is the sort of something great every so often. You get this string of mediocrity, ongoing mediocrity projects that don't offend anybody. You know, like, they don't make anybody upset.
Sure. And, you know, there's a lot to that. I can't fault someone for trying to protect their career. And especially, I don't know it from Adam, but I would imagine that the music publishing business, much like the movie business, I got to believe that at the end of the day, is you're just guessing.
Well, you think
react.
I think there are some people, I mean, just like there are in the movies and you know, book publishing, there are some people who know what is good. Mm. But the music industry was once an exponential spinoff of the furniture industry, right? So, like, furniture companies began incorporating phonographs into their pieces, into their chests of drawers and their coffee tables and stuff was so. And then the selling of content for those new devices that were incorporated into furniture was like this exponential manufacturing spinoff. So the music industry is an artifact of the furniture industry, right? Huh. That's exactly how it worked. And, you know, there were people who didn't consider themselves to be gatekeepers at one time. They were just kind of like, oh, look at this interesting thing. Music is selling. Well, that's great. Let's try and find some talent to make our music the best music that can sell more furniture. And, you know, that was the way that, if you watch, there's a very cool interview with Frank Zappa where he describes the difference in the music industry executive culture, where he came up at first. Music industry executives would be these sort of cigar chomping old men, and there's lots of problems with that, but white guys, but they would kind of not consider themselves to be clairvoyant. They would say, I don't know what's a hit, throw it out there, see if it works. You know, they were kind of like experimenting, they were tinkering. And the next wave of record industry executives who took their place in the 70s and 80s, they thought they knew what was good. They were like, oh, I'm the tastemaker, I'm the hit maker, I know what's happening.
Sure.
And that was sort of toxic stupidity because they rode the coattails of everybody switching over from vinyl to CD. And we saw where that inflationary lack of a plan led us into the 90s, late 90s. CDs were $25, you know.
Right.
They had one hit, you know. And of course, then we have the backlash from Napster. And everybody is still saying, all these executives are still saying, oh, I'm the gatekeeper. I know what I'm talking about, you know. But really what he is he's like a fearful, like, prick who doesn't want to let go of the reins. And, you know, really has gotten further and further away from making his former furniture company a delivery system for talent, which is what they were kind of toying with when they were saying, I don't know what's a hit, stick, you know, throw it out there, include it with this couch set and see if people like it. So that's, they take themselves too seriously. You know, they forgot who they were and they started to try and call shots that are not callable. You know,
call shots that are not callable.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. So. Huh. But I do think there are people out there who have a good sense of the zeitgeist and also a sense of, like, what's appealing to people on mass scale. You know, this is the business of politics I'm talking about more than art. But yeah, I think those people exist. I just don't think that they last long in the system that has quarterly reporting to Wall Street.
Right.
You know,
but out of service to our listeners, they should know that you have agreed to play Teenage Dirtbag for us, which
I certainly will.
My man,
you have some choices, though. You're going to have to make a decision. I have three guitars that I could do this on. Two of the guitars are over 100 years old. One of them was the actual guitar that the acoustic parts for Teenage Dirtbag were recorded on initially. The first version in 1999. and the most recent. So I still have the same guitar, still works. Then there's, I can play it for you on my original Martin 1997, I think it is, a Martin 00016TR, which is the guitar that I recorded all the distorted guitar parts with on the first album, and also is in the Teenage Dirtbag video, the one with the stickers.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can try and do something I've never done before, which is play it on a nylon string guitar that's even older than the oldest one, like, or the older one. It's the really gnarly old nylon string parlor guitar that I found in Nashville. And it's so interesting. And it sounds like, I don't know if you're familiar with the guitars, the clean guitar sounds in Love Is Enough From Hell and Leroy, those songs from our first album, that sort of plinky, almost like a Tom Petty song. It sounds exactly like that. It's got that vibe. So you have choices. You have choices. And also, I'll have to run and get them because they live in a humidified zone.
I would hope for no less. Well, I thought I had you beat because I watched your interview with Chris Demakis a little bit ago. And I remember you gave him the choice. I was all prepared for the give me the old 130 one. But then when you said that you haven't done this before, we got to go with the nylon. It's got to be
nylon. It's going to be a novel experiment. Is it? Okay. Okay. You want me to do it now? You want me to go get it now or what?
Yeah. Would you mind?
Okay. No problem. I'll be right back.
No worries. Thanks.
So here it is. You can take a look at it. This thing is like, I don't even know what to say about how old this thing is. It's a million years old. It's been cracked right down the middle. I don't know if you can see that.
Yep.
And been repaired. So it stays in tune, but then suddenly we'll go out of tune. So I'm just warning you ahead of time that that might be a thing.
Hey, okay? We'll try it. I'll introduce. Just let me know when you're ready, Brendan.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, playing his hit song, Teenage Dirtbag, Brendan B. Brown. Brendan.
Here we go.
Her name, Noel. I have a dream about her. She rings my bell. I got gym class in half an hour. Oh, how she rocks in kids and two songs. But she doesn't know who I am. And she doesn't give a damn about me. Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby, with me.
I've never played this song on this guitar before, so I gotta make sure I don't break it.
Her boyfriend's a dick, and he brings a gun to school, and he'd simply kick my ass if he knew the truth. He lives on my block, and he drives an IRA, but he doesn't know who I am. And he doesn't give a damn about me. Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby, with me. Come with me Friday.
Jazz version.
That was awesome.
I forgot to tell you this. I don't know if you can see this, but I don't have a strap for this guitar. There are no
I noticed that, yeah.
And so because it's so fragile, I don't want to drill into it. But so I was just resting it on top of the console down here.
Oh, I see.
Just sort of like this, like a cello or something. And at one point, I made a mistake because it slipped on the leather here. So that was an authentic non-Pro Tools corrected performance.
Hell yeah. Thank you so much for doing that, dude. That was awesome.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, the whole time I was like, okay, don't jump in and sing with them. Don't jump in. Don't do it, Josh. Oh, man. So what was it that, not to go from ecstatic and euphoric to super depressing, but what was it that made you write that song? I know AC/DC, and what was the... Well, I'll just let you tell the story. Sorry.
Well, I guess I didn't...
Ricky Queso?
Yeah, there was a murder. It's important to mention that the murder that happened in my hometown, the Satan murder, wasn't the direct causality for the song. Right. I wrote that song because I had been, on a sort of conveyor belt early in life, high school, college. They were all part of somebody else's ideas and somebody else's plans, and they weren't my own. And I was all the while, as much as I was preparing for life the way that you're supposed to, I was playing music more consistently and ferociously than anything else that I had ever done. And the only thing that kind of had been stopping me was I didn't really understand how to do music as a career. Nobody in my family does it. Nobody before them ever did it. We barely know a few people, and we don't really know. I mean, my parents knew, there had one friend who was loosely had retired from the music industry in the 80s, a guy who really didn't, was in it for a while, but in it in a different way. And he gave me some advice, but there was precious little to go on for going and moving to New York City and getting yourself a record deal. That was I had a vague notion of that, but nothing, right. No details, no context. So one of the things that I thought I needed was something that was sort of holistically my own, that was as correct to me and my songwriting sensibilities and influences as it could possibly be. And so I had to go back, way back deep into the dark corners of my childhood to remember and learn some things again, and then bring them into the context of modern young adult life, So that's what it was. And that's where it came from, this need to have something out front that represented your ideas perfectly, and that was crafted to be delivered with the most impact. So I recorded it 4 times over the course of 5 years. I really tinkered with it to make sure that it was dialed in the way that I had wanted it to be. So it's interesting. Nobody has ever really asked that question that way before. Why? What made me write it the way it is? Just that's an interesting question, and I've never answered that way either, I don't think. Oh. But that's the facts. Took me a long time to go from verse 1, chorus 1 to the rest of it, because I wanted to do 3 acts, and I wanted to do this sort of revelation act as the third, kind of piece. I also wanted there to be a part in the song that was better than the chorus, which the oh yeah section we refer to. So it's a complicated little piece of music. In its part arrangement, it's an A, B, C, A, B, C, D, A, C, or A, B, C, D. So it's like, when you do a song diagram, I've never done that before, so I got it wrong for my own song. But clearly, it was more than 4 minutes and 20 seconds long, which kind of precluded it from being a radio song, or at least then everybody else's sort of notion of what a radio song is. And we decided not to bow to that. So having a record label that was good at radio, which is what Columbia Records was, when we started, that was not the plan. That was like, we didn't have a radio single. We had a 4 minute and 20 second long Teenage Dirtbag.
Sure.
And what happened was, instead of them changing the song, its length, its arrangement, cut out a verse, whatever, the song changed them. The song went into Columbia Records via Kevin Patrick, who became our A&R guy. And it kind of like poisoned the well, you know, it was like it went in there as an unkempt, not correctly timed radio single, the presentation, and it should have gotten rejected, but it didn't. It got Donny Einer's attention and he wanted to do it. So that's why it started where it did and ended up where it wound up. And then it became an orphan again for, you know, and it's like it had this little splash in 2000 and 2001. It blew up overseas. 2002, overseas was starting to die down and it went back into the wilderness, you know. And over the years, it didn't have any sort of big champions behind it, didn't have a manager. We got off of Columbia Records 2004. You know, the song was forced to do whatever it has done, it did by itself, you know, without cheerleading. And that was mostly because we didn't have any money and we didn't have anything to offer any managers that was worth their time.
Sure.
So it kind of like trucked along and grew its own little patch of moss, you know, or mold. And, and that's how it wound up.
That's extraordinary, man, because it's kind of funny. You made me think, so didn't you run into some issues with the "He brings a gun to school"?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they hated that. They wanted,
because that was right after Columbine, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. We delivered the record on the 20th anniversary of Columbine Massacre. So it was in the news, and here I was handing this record over that had Don in it, and Gun School in it. And they were kind of like just averse to the whole discussing it at all, even though I had framed it as ethically, I think, or I hoped, but they were not willing to have the conversation on any front. So the short story is that they insisted that I sing a different verse and I refused and they censored it instead. That's what happened.
Gotcha.
Which was fine with me because at the time in New York, listening to, you know, Hot 97, you know,
right,
hip hop station, there was lots of profanity scratched out that was getting played in drive time, you know, prime time, you know. So I was okay with that kind of an edit. I always thought that something that was withheld from you would become more alluring anyway. So, like, you know, do me a favor, I guess.
Yeah. It was a Streisand effect at play, right?
I guess. I'm not sure which one that is. But,
oh, yeah, it's basically just the idea that if you say something is a secret or is prohibited or censored, right, that increases the desire of people to want to know what it is under the hood, as you say.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, good stuff. Okay, so I'd love to know. Okay, so the song comes out. It's a big hit.
Overseas,
yeah. How is it that you deal with the song becoming a big success? I know that might sound like an odd question, but I think you might be able to get my drift. Like, where were you when you found out the song was going to be successful?
Oh, that's a really tough question to answer because I don't take anything for granted. In this industry, I feel like things can change real fast. And, you know, just because Teenage Dirtbag is in the memories of the minds of people at this moment and gets whatever spins it gets on YouTube and Spotify, I don't believe for a second that that's written in stone. And that, you know, like, I think that, you know, so never wealthy myself as a kid or, you know, early adult. So I don't really have the feeling of trusting that it's there to stay, you know, like that kind of, so I don't put much on it being this like forever, like thing, or that it's, I haven't experienced it arriving and making it or it being, you know, what it's become or whatever, except for when we're playing live and we get it right and we get that real time, you know, we make them forget about the record. And we make them know that it's a song that's done by people. Those moments live, they feel like hard memories that are written in stone. Those ones do. But I know that commodities and things that are sold and bought, or they come and go and they fad out and then they disappear and so on. So I don't presume anything in terms of its longevity. I just feel lucky that it has done so much work for us to this point, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, thanks, Matt. Matt, Brendan. I saw Matt, the name card at the bottom of the screen here.
Oh, right, Matthew. Yeah, because I'm on Matthew's Zoom. Yeah, sorry. Zoom.
No worries.
Must throw people for a loop on that. I apologize.
No, I'm easily confused. Believe me, it's not you.
That makes two of us.
So, you know, obviously you've performed in front of huge crowds. I mean, you know, tens of thousands of people. And I'm just curious, what's that rush like on stage? Do you ever get nervous before you go out?
No, I try to do a lot of sound check, a lot of pre-production work to make sure nothing goes wrong and that we can just glide through song to song without having any technical issues. But they do come up, so we try to incorporate them into the show as best we can. Mm. That's the only kind of stuff that makes me feel anything that would stop me from delivering the music makes me feel a little bit nervous, but it doesn't make me feel angry or anything like that. It just makes me kind of like bum out, like I didn't prepare enough, you know?
Oh, sure.
So, but I only get, like I said, the wedding thing, like when it matters for some other reason, that makes me really nervous when it's not about my stupid band, when it's about somebody else's, like a gift to somebody on that level makes me feel like I have bigger, way bigger responsibility than being in a band could ever be. So it's uncharted waters, kind of, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
That world. But as far as just regular shows and, you know, if there's two people in the audience or if there's 200,000, I still have the same core feeling about get this right for these people. Mm. Make sure that they hang on every note and that it's delivered to them the way that they expect it to be and not with some ego bullshit or subpar preparation or, you know, any of the pitfalls that accompany live performance. And there's tons of them. You know, you never stop learning about them, no matter how long you do it. Something else will go wrong on stage. But yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. Excellent. Man, I can't help but want to ask, is there a particularly embarrassing unplanned moment that came out on stage that you'd like to share?
Oh, I mean, I am a walking embarrassment on stage. a living, breathing cringe person. I mean, like, you look over at Matthew and he's just shaking his head all damn show, like, you know, you are shut up, just stop talking, you know, and don't stop talking, just stop doing anything, go away, you know? No, I kind of live in cringe. I've never been cool and don't have any plans on becoming cool. So, you know, I'll be perfectly honest with you, total honesty. Okay, so you'll see that I'm wearing this sweatshirt here. Right. Well, it's a little warm with all this equipment humming in this room to be wearing this sweatshirt. And the reason I'm wearing this sweatshirt is because I did a podcast yesterday and I had the same shirt on because I slept in it and I haven't taken a shower. So, I mean, like, you know, you're getting the raw, you know, the raw data here. You know?
I love it. That's what I want.
I'm not overly concerned with how I come across in terms of visuals and things. A lot of what we do visually is just a collision of forms, like a big puffy guitar that looks like an acoustic but sounds like a metal, you know, like it's just sort of like the dichotomy and the irony of it is clumsy, you know, supposed
sure
to.
No, that's great, man, and good on you. Similarly, I've been wearing this shirt. I think I did actually sleep in the shirt. I happen to work from home, so
you know. And everybody else, I mean, like, hey, yeah, you know, you got to wear the shirt that you need to wear, man. Whatever.
No. There was one of the videos I saw of Wheatus doing Teenage Dirtbag. You guys were at a library, and there was a really fun, I don't expect to remember the specific event, but there was a really funny comment on the YouTube thing that I wanted to just share with you. And I'm sure it was meant as a compliment, but it was, you know, various hats and glasses and beard slightly unkept and all that, you know, throughout the band. And the comment was, this looks like a bunch of music teachers got together and formed a band.
I'll take it.
My brain just flagged it and I was like, I bet Brendan will get a kick out of that.
Yeah, that's you know, I can't argue with that, you know.
I'd love to discuss how you get past being stuck lyrically in the course of writing a song.
Yeah, Richard Marx, who I'm sure you're familiar with. Yeah. He, on one of his vlogs, he said he reads Pablo Neruda, one of the great romanticist poets, past that. And I'm just curious if you have any processes that you go through, any sources you turn to.
I have that with Mark Twain. I have that with Kurt Vonnegut. I have that when I was a younger person, I had it with Bukowski, but then I kind of realized what a dick he was. You know, sort of absurdist stuff, like the night I f***ed my alarm clock, like that.
Right.
I also, I'll watch the news on mute while having some other thing on, like, I'll throw on the, like, the BBC, right?
Yeah.
And then on the phone, I'll have, like, a Joyce Maynard novel being, like, the audiobook. And it creates a little bit more rapid fire of cross-section of ideas. And
interesting.
I think it kind of triggers a little bit of synesthesia, where you're mixing and matching the neuron paths in your brain for creativity. They need to be kind of be tricked or bored into crisscrossing and coming up with something new. And I find that that stimulus works sometimes. Huh. The other thing that's totally undervalued and underrated is alone time. Like straight up lockdown, not quarantine, but like, I mean, like where the doorbell's not ringing and the phone is not on and the TV's not on and you're just alone time with the guitar or something. That helps too. Because boredom is the original source of creativity.
Yeah.
So, you know, that helps. In terms of authors or poets or anything like that, there are so many more that I would be forgetting to tell you, you know, that I go in and out of phases with. I can sit and watch any Denzel Washington movie, no matter what it is. I can just watch him act and get something.
You know,
the same is true for, I like a lot of Brad Pitt movies where he plays a character that's sort of ridiculous. Like
12 Monkeys.
Yeah. Or Burn After Reading. There's another one where he's this preposterous, you know, jackass. I like movies, American stories about scumbags that are not forgiving. Like we glorify a lot of scumbaggery in our lives, in our culture, in our history. But every once in a while, a true story about somebody being a total piece of shit comes out. And it's like The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford is like that. It's like it does not, no one's off the hook. These are just some dead ender former secessionist rebel scumbags who are at the end of their line and they're all turning on each other because they're scumbags and that's what scumbags do. And it's like, you know, yeah, stories that break myths wide open are attractive to me. The Alan Turing movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, The Imitation Game, I think it's called.
Yep, that's it.
He was a sympathetic character overall, but they did a good job of making him this insufferable bastard, you know, when at times misunderstood indeed, but like I like a story that's like where you almost could hate one of the characters that you're not supposed to hate. That makes me feel real, a little bit more real, you know.
I get that.
For that reason, I also watch Ken Burns documentaries. In particular, the one on Richard Nixon is pretty great, and the one about New York City is pretty great. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, it comes in from everywhere, you know.
Sure. That's awesome, Brendan. Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, like for me, so in my day job, I'm a writer is my main kind of deal. And when I'm stuck, I like to read Salman Rushdie.
He's amazing.
Yeah. All right. God. The way it's phenomenal to think that English is his second language. Every time I think of that, I feel so small.
But, yeah, well, people forget that he's a linguistics expert. Yes. He's like, that's his whole thing. And then the Satanic Verses was this sort of blip on his radar for his intellect and his whole discipline, you know. He's incredible.
Well, yeah, and he wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Golden House, which I loved. It's how he describes magical realism, being able to actually poetically state how an apparition appears and putting him in setting. And the fact that he can make you feel like you're right there watching it is amazing. Cool, man. Well, look, I know we're coming up on our time. I just have a couple questions left. Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Awesome. Hey, I appreciate you. One thing that we didn't touch on, and I want to make sure that we do, Brendan, in 2020, you re-recorded the song Teenage Dirtbag.
Yep.
And I'm just curious what prompted you to do that.
The masters, the original masters, the multi-tracks, they seem to be lost. We have good reason to believe that they don't exist anymore. They might be somewhere buried in the Columbia Records library, but unless they were transferred from the tapes that I gave them, they are definitely deteriorated beyond the point of being able to listen to. So
that sucks.
Yeah. So what we did was I had a set of tapes that were falling apart that were the sort of penultimate and a few revisions prior. And I brought them to Dream Hire, which is a company that I think that shut down since, the multimedia transfer company in Queens. And we did, we were successful in transferring the majority of what I had on tape onto multi-track Pro Tools. And it was imperfect. There were missing pieces, corruptions along the way that did not play back that weren't registering. But what I did wind up with was all of the original album tracks from album one for drums, bass, most guitars, a little bit of percussion, and almost no vocal. So I had, I would say, bit by bit, because one song, Sunshine, was entirely lost, I would say that I was able to look at and listen to approximately 68 to 78% of the album, the multi-track. And that was fortunate because we got the click tracks. The original click tracks were there. The original drum and bass tracks were there. A few of the decisions that we had made that we could, you know, kind of understand, we could look at. And it was a forensic exercise, you know. It was like trying to figure out how Frank Lloyd Wright did things if you had to unearth one of his buildings in the Northeast after 1,000 years of being buried under the soil. Like, that was kind of what it was like. We were able to, like, intuit and deduce a few things that we wouldn't have been able to had we only had the original album CD, you know. So,
yeah,
which everybody has, there's plenty of, but the multi-tracks are another story. And we were, piece by piece, we replaced each instrument. So the drums that Leo played were performed along to the original bass track, and then we replaced the bass track. And then I played my guitars along to the new bass and the new drums, and we stacked it up like that. And so far, we also dug out of the vault about 12 other songs that were from years past that were so much like the stuff on album one that we shelved them, not wanting to make anything that sounded like album one. So we had right. this 12 dozen other songs that we started referring to as the alternate universe first album, you know. And now we're releasing them in pairs. This Friday, the 21st, the fifth pair, so 10 songs total, will be released on Friday as Truffles, the first album track, and that's re-recorded, and we call it Truffles 2020. And then it's sort of alternate universe, anti-particle, a song called People. And if you look on our Spotify, you will see Teenage Dirtbag 2020 has a song called Mope that's with it on its sort of double A side. Hump 'em and Dump 'em has a song called FBSM. I'd Never Write a Song About You has a song called Temporary Song. And then there's Sunshine has a song, a partner called Through. So there's these pairs. And Friday will be Truffles and People will drop together. So that's halfway through the re-release, 10 songs, eventually going to be 20, or I think 21. And we're going to finish it up by the summertime. Then I'm scheduled to cut the record onto vinyl straight off of our DSD system, which will be the first of its kind, I believe. I don't think anybody has cut an 11 kilohertz DSD master off of directly off the system. So that's going to be a new experiment with my friend Paul in Brooklyn, his cutting lab where he cuts records. So yeah, we're going to be done with it, and that'll be the 2020 anniversary edition, which COVID long delayed.
That's awesome, Brendan. No, thank you so much. If you weren't a singer or a songwriter, what do you think you'd be in life, Brendan?
If I was not dead and I found a way to be happy, I would probably be a welder or a woodworker of some kind. Some kind of craftsman would be very satisfying to me. I still love to build things. The shelves behind me, I built them myself. There's a few guitar cabinets in the other room with speakers and everything that I built by myself from scratch. You know, go to Home Depot, buy some wood, glue, screw, you know, cut, you know, the whole thing. So it's kind of the fabrication of something. I'm fascinated by welders. You know, they blow me away. They do incredible things. Any of the construction trades where things are built from scratch, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Brendan B. Brown, how can people find out about you, sir?
Weedus.com, Facebook. /Weedus, Weedus Official on Instagram and YouTube. Twitter is just Weedus, @Weedus, I should say. I'm the only one who really does the Twitter account. Joey and Matthew kind of handle the Instagram and the Facebook, and I'm mostly on Twitter having conversations. I don't know why I find that one the most tolerable. I know some people can't stand it. The one I never go on because I just can't is Facebook. I never go on Facebook myself, but we are there.
More than I am.
All the announcements happen on Facebook, and that's one of the places that things are going on for us. So yeah, Facebook /Weedus, you know.
Right on, man. Brendan, thank you so much for taking the time for me, man. This was a blast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for paying attention and for caring and for reaching out to us. We really appreciate it. It was fun.
Off I go, man. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged,
Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.